Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan read the paper, Sunday, November 5th, 2017. And we did something with the clocks. I don't know. We set them back. We moved them up.
Right.
Some of the clocks moved themselves.
It's darker than it used to be.
It's very dark.
Right.
It seems like it's the middle of the night.
But we'll hang in there.
All right.
It'll help us when it comes time to harvest the crops. That's my understanding.
That's
the way this works.
Well, good. Because we need all the help we can get.
Right.
Yes.
So we spent Tamsin and Dan apart this weekend. We were not together this weekend. I was at the GE Management Development Institute, which is a complex in Ossining, New York, that GE put together initially for itself, and now it rents out to other organizations like the law firm where I work, which operates as a retreat. You get the whole group together, in my case, 150 partners of the firm, to talk about whatever is deemed worthy of talking about.
Is it about just getting you guys together? Bonding?
Well, that's the question, of course. Well, you don't have to choose between them, but when you evaluate the value, what you're doing, you say, well, were the presentations uniformly excellent? Did we advance the ball substantively on all sorts of matters? And I mean, that's a lot to accomplish. So I think I'd be hard-pressed to say yes and yes on that. But there is value in getting the group together, especially when you have offices as far-flung as London and Paris and Moscow. You get everyone together for just 2 or 3 days, and inevitably you end up having conversations with the folks that you otherwise would not run into at all in person, and develop more of a relationship and more of an understanding of what each other is doing. And there's some value to that. I was highly skeptical of that going in,
mm-hmm.
But I'm becoming a little bit of a convert, and if anything, what I heard many people saying during the retreat is that is the principal value. And for that reason, one might consider having more in the way of social type things, you know, like in the summer, what would be kayaking, or there are all kinds of crazy suggestions.
Back in the day.
Yeah.
Well, there used to be more social things.
Well, never in a retreat. I mean, there are some things you can do in a retreat.
Oh, you want to do these things, more retreats?
No, not more retreats. Same number of retreats, but less substantive presentations, more people relaxing and chatting or having something in the way of, I don't know what that social event would be. Some people had suggestions, but didn't register with me, something short of laser tag. But there are things that folks might do, and they do in circumstances like this, depending on what the surrounding temperature is.
You know? So you see a value to the bonding aspect.
I think there is a value in it. And then, so I'm won over on that. I do think there's something to that. Especially when you interact in your own little cluster of folks in your own little specialty.
Mm-hmm.
But the organization can benefit from having more extensive connections with people across the firm. So I do see some value in that.
Okay. And not that much to be gained business-wise.
Well, don't paint me into that corner. You're going to get me in trouble. I would say that the principal value to me is the connections, making the connections with the folks across the company.
And it was, you know, probably even a beautiful drive for you.
No. But
really?
I don't mind. Yeah, it's not a beautiful drive.
It was a pretty day.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you, how'd you manage without me?
I just did chores.
Really?
Yeah.
Come on, I know you went to the movies.
I did go to the movies.
I
did chores. I corrected tests like a crazy person.
That's good.
And allowed myself to go out to the movies to see Loving Vincent.
You found a movie that you thought I would not be enthused about.
I was informed by you that you were not enthused about.
Well, explain the movie. People understand why.
It's an art movie. It's about Vincent Van Gogh.
There you go.
But what makes it especially intriguing is that it's animated.
Yeah.
And but it's not digital animation. It's something over 100 painters were commissioned to paint in the style
of Vincent Van Gogh.
Van Gogh.
That's right. So
and animate that.
Right.
62,000 frames.
Right. That's amazing.
And visually it was stunning. Visually, it was absolutely stunning.
So it's almost as if Vincent Van Gogh made the movie himself, about himself, by doing all the paintings of all the frames.
Yeah, I mean, maybe he could have. I mean, he was he was pretty prolific in his short span of his artistic career.
Oh, it's easier to do. Probably cheaper this way.
Might have been
way.
Right up his alley. Here, here, Vince, why don't you try this? So do a bunch of these.
All right, so it's visually, we'll put them together. Visually stunning. I'm going to grant you that.
Yeah. You know what? It was a little long.
Ooh. Okay.
There are moments you're going, oh, yada, yada, yada. Oh, okay, really? Let's just resolve this.
Oh, really?
But it really was fabulous to see, and it was reasonably interesting, and the actors were good,
yeah.
And I recognized the actors.
Right. You told me
some of them. Saoirse Ronan.
Right.
Actually, and two of the actors we see in the Poldark series. So I am a little intrigued about the process, and I haven't been able to find that out that much online about the actual process, because to some extent it looked like they were painting over filming.
Yeah.
I don't know how that's done, yeah. But certainly.
But there were live actors in it. I thought there would be none.
Oh, but, they were all live actors, and they were all pretty.
And they weren't just
well
voice.
Known.
They
no.
Yeah, when you say...
Well, I mean, I don't know what you mean by live. They were painted versions of themselves.
Oh, okay. That's what I'm asking.
No, yeah. It wasn't like Mary Poppins, you know, doing the dance with the...
The penguins. Yeah.
The penguins. Yeah, well, No.
That was a great moment.
It was all... Yeah. It was all to, you know,
okay,
paint.
So
it was all
is this so we're,
brushstrokes, moving.
So Saoirse Ronan, of course, was the woman who was in Brooklyn, who's in and is in the Greta Gerwig movie
that people are
up.
Going nuts
They are going
about
nuts about it. Right.
Lady Bird.
Lady Bird. And...
Are we going to see Lady Bird?
Are there paintings that look like Vincent van Gogh stuff?
You know, it's supposed to be fabulous. I will see it. I don't know why you're being poopy
you're very
about this.
I'm not being poopy. I want to see
because I know you're not going to let me see Thor.
Oh, no, I want to see Thor.
Oh.
We can see it tonight. Let's hurry up. We'll see it tonight.
All right.
But we should inform people that we're big Poldark fans. So even though we don't know the name of the actors and actresses, this is the two leads.
We do. Aidan Turner.
Yeah.
And Eleanor Tomlinson.
Boy, you're all over this. And they're the two leads. They play Poldark, Russ Poldark.
They do
Poldark
not play
and,
leads
in Desdemona or something.
Yeah. They don't play leads in. Well, they're important.
Okay, good.
But Poldark is just like a boatman.
Listen, if I knew Ross Poldark was in this movie, I might have
had his shirt on. So you know, don't get excited.
Oh, thanks. Thanks very much.
Not on a horse.
Yeah. So we had some books jumped out at us. Not literally. But
I don't know anything about this book.
No. You wanted to talk about this.
I have to talk about a book first.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So this is of interest: A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived.
Yeah.
By Adam Rutherford.
The key word is brief.
Yes, and it's reviewed by Charles Mann, and he starts out by saying, "A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived is not particularly brief." Nor is it a history, and not concerned with everyone who ever lived.
Oh,
you know, this sounds so Wall Street Journal, you know? It's like the cranky old man definition of review.
Well,
you know?
It does sound like
not
they're all
as advertised.
But I thought they liked the book.
Well, it has a lot to say.
Yeah.
I guess. And I guess the biggest, it just really points out that we're a big mishmash.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, you and I are related to royalty.
Really?
Yes.
I had to come up with it.
Because Mr. Rutherford says everyone is.
Oh.
He says, you are of Viking descent because everyone is.
Oh, really?
You are of Saracen, Roman, Goth, Hun, Jewish, because you get the idea. If you're a human being on Earth, you almost certainly have Nefertiti, Confucius, anyone you know from the history books in your
genetic makeup. I always had you down for Nefertiti. That's not a surprise to me. But well, that's good. So
also debunks any ability to differentiate people so much on the basis of race.
Right.
Say a black person and a white person genetically have more in common than two black people.
Yeah.
So race doesn't sum up.
Well, I guess one thing I did pick up before it got too complicated for me was that the human genome turned out to be much more complicated than they had anticipated.
Yeah.
And that's what leads to this, because of all the complexity, there are so many ways that people draw from traits from different chromosomes and the like, that there's just no making clear distinction based on race or anything else.
Right. And he does debunk a few things, like the term Celtic or Celtic.
Yeah.
He says... doesn't turn up in the genetics. Okay. Welsh, Breton, Irish, Cornish, Scottish, they're all there. Celtic is a modern invention of a presumed people that is not reflected in Britain's DNA.
Well, listen, I was never hung up on the Celtic idea. But
well, a lot of people are.
Is that
right? A lot of people, oh, good Lord, there are Celtic gift shops.
Really? Okay.
So, right. So anyway.
So, well, that is interesting. So the book that I focused on was reviewed in the Times. And here's the story, okay? So let me give you the story first, and I'll tell you what the book is. Apparently, according to the book, Adolf Hitler and Joseph Goebbels saw Hollywood, I'm reading from the review, as central to their efforts to win over the American public and the world to their cause. As a result, the Nazis planned terrorist attacks against Jews and plotted to kill high-profile Hollywood figures, including Al Jolson, Charlie Chaplin, and Samuel Goldwyn. And it's only because one Leon Lewis, one of the founding members of the Anti-Defamation League, recruited fellow military veterans and others to create a spy ring that these plans were foiled. So I'm reading this and I'm saying, well, this is one of those crazy books where people try to, you know, write about what might have happened if we had lost the war and all that kind of stuff. And then it occurs to me that the story's true.
That it occurs to you?
They're saying the story's true. It's a book called Hitler in Los Angeles. It's by a person named Stephen Ross. And he's saying this really happened, that Hitler actually sent...
I understand folks, he's saying it. Is there, like, documentary evidence?
He's a historian.
Evidence?
He never wrote a popular book before in his life. He's a okay. You know...
So because he's never written anything popular, it must be true?
Apparently, he
you know, you've been a lawyer for too long.
The review
time.
Was about
just
all
just because it's boring doesn't make it true.
All right, it purports to be true. But the point is that he describes all the boxes he went through. Well, he started in the most... in the craziest way, he was doing some research in Edward G. Robinson. Apparently, Edward G. Robinson done some work with respect to counterintelligence, if you can believe that. And
that's the guy I would put in charge of counterintelligence.
Right, he had a box of documents at USC. Many of these archives are at USC. And he poured through it, and he found out that there was this crazy story about a Nazi agent, although he turned out to be a double agent. He was sent over to Hollywood in order to try to prevent Hollywood from making anti-Nazi movies, because it was at a time it was not clear how soon the U.S. was going to jump into World War II and if they were going to align themselves with Britain right away and put themselves at risk. And they thought that Hollywood really affected public opinion. And this person turned out to be a double agent who was actually working against Hitler. And it was helpful in foiling this plot against Al Jolson. I mean, look,
So are you going to read this book?
No, it's too crazy. But you know, this is a truth is stranger than fiction moment here.
Well, here's a book you might want to read.
All right, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mrs. Osmond by John Banville.
I'm all in. No, I don't. Who's John Banville?
Well, sure you do. He wrote The Untouchable, The Sea... He's a big British writer.
All right, fine.
No,
I don't know. I'm not.
But anyway,
not coming to mind. Yeah.
So, Mrs. Osmond is a sequel.
Yeah.
To Portrait of a Lady, yeah. By Henry James. So this review.
So he's writing a sequel for Henry James.
That's questionable. Didn't you always wonder what happened to Isabel Archer?
It sounds like a Doll's House Part Two.
So Mr. Gora is actually a. Henry James expert who teaches at Smith.
Oh, good.
Which sounds plausible.
Now I'm all
and,
in.
He reviews the book and he describes it as Mrs. Osmond is a tribute paid by a great writer to a greater one. And I expect in rereading James' own novel, I'll eventually be able to forget about this one. Maybe not the next time, but the time after that. Nevertheless, there are some scenes here, a few but enough, when Mr. Banville drives James himself from my mind.
Whoa.
And he's a James guy.
All right. Well, that's something.
So that's interesting. And he does point out that Banville perfectly picks up James's writing style, mm-hmm. his voice, mm-hmm. his structure.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like a remarkable feat.
Mm-hmm.
So
all right. Well, that's good. That's
worth a look.
Yeah. All right, so I've been asked to explain the World Series. And who better to ask, really, when you think about
it? Yeah, you should explain it, because...
I know, you were quite distraught that I picked the Dodgers, and the Dodgers...
Over and over and over again, emphatically.
Yeah, all right. Well, I can explain what happened here, if you'll just let me.
I know during the series you were giving advice to the Dodgers
and they failed
about
to take
how
it.
To proceed. And they did not seem to be listening.
And that's why
through
they
the
lost.
TV.
So that's the full explanation.
Okay.
No, they lost to the Astros. And the question really is... how did the Astros do it? Let's focus on the Astros, not the Dodgers so much. And the answer is this. Three different aspects to it. One is that some people say they tanked. That's what people like to say, they tanked. In other words, they went through a three-year period where they lost 100 games each season, and they set themselves up to be successful several years in the future. And there's a little something to that. 100 games is a lot of games to lose, all right? What did they benefit? How did they benefit? How did they set themselves up that way? Well, it did this for them. Number one, it gave them very high draft picks. And they had like the first draft pick for 3 years in a row, and these fellows all became stars. But the other thing is that by not spending anything on players just for the purpose of being mediocre, they saved a lot of money, and they put all that money into their farm system. And some years ago, and you're aware of this, Sports Illustrated was onto this, that the Astros were building for this future in this kind of interesting way. And they said 3 or 4 years ago, they had a mock cover saying, Astros, you're World Series champions 2017. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. So that was one prong of it. The second is that the Astros are as advanced as anyone, perhaps more than other teams, in terms of analytics. Jeff Luhnow is the general manager. And they do very advanced statistical analysis, very advanced. There are degrees of that, and they are totally, totally in on that. And that I'll just give you two examples of that quickly. Number one, the fellow who won the game in the seventh game of the World Series, a fellow named Charlie Morton, not a successful pitcher in his career, 34 years old, they signed him. And they signed him because they liked the spin rate on his curveball. They analyzed that, and they said, with the proper training and adjustments, a fellow with that kind of spin rate can be successful, and he was.
It's interesting that you bring up analytics.
Yeah.
Because the Astros beat the Yankees.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yankees lost to the Astros.
Right.
And shortly after
that. I know where you're going with this.
The
Joe
Yankees
Girardi,
fired.
Joe Girardi.
Girardi, who, what I heard. On the, you know, ladies' home journal type radio shows I listen to.
The lady home journal circuit.
They were saying that he's kind of anti-analytics.
Right. Yeah, no.
And so you wonder if they weren't thinking, this is the way to go, and we've got to move to someone who can do it.
You and the other ladies are onto something to some degree. Although I will say that Brian Cashman, the general manager, is not into analytics to the degree Jeff Luhnow is. So this is really an extreme in that connection. But you're right. There's a little bit of a divide in baseball. Is how important analytics is. The other thing they did analytically was they set it up so that no pitcher pitched more than 160 innings during the season so they'd be healthy this late in the season. 160 innings is the minimum that a pitcher can pitch to qualify for what's called the ERA award, lowest ERA. In other words, it's considered the minimum to be a legitimate starter. No one hit the minimum, which is bizarre. I mean, there were pitchers generally are prized for going over 200 innings. Years ago, it was close to 300 innings. So that's a huge sea change. And the third thing is that the Astros were lucky. And you have to be lucky. In other words, it's not a matter of looking at the Astros, they did everything right, and the Dodgers did everything wrong. Those are the two teams that did everything right, frankly. And that's why they're there at the end. But there was one critical difference. At the end, toward the end of the season, there's something called the trading deadline at the end of July, in which by that point, if you want a player, you got to get them fast.
Yeah.
And to try to make your team that much stronger, you get a rental, as they call it. Two pitchers, very similar profiles, Justin Verlander and Yu Darvish. And there's no way to tell which one would be successful and which not when those deals were made. The Astros got Justin Verlander, and Justin Verlander was fantastic for the last few months of the season and into the playoffs. Yu Darvish was not. And when he pitched well for a little while, but he was sort of an epic fail in the World Series. I can't think of another pitcher who was as poor as Darvish was in the World Series. He had two starts. He couldn't get out of the second inning both times. He pretty much sunk the Dodgers' chances. And again, that's just lucky. That's just lucky.
You couldn't have soft-pedaled that a little bit in case Darvish's grandmother is listening or something?
Okay. My odds are against it.
That's pretty strong language there.
But it was rough. It was rough.
All right.
He seems like a very nice guy.
It sounds pretty strategic. I assume luck had to be involved, but sounds like the Astros were taking kind of a long view
for sure
in several different areas. In terms of that pitch count, in terms of personnel development.
No, I agree.
Interesting. Okay, so what else do we have here? Well, you know, some sort of good news. That is an article on living well even with Alzheimer's. So Alzheimer's is always on my mind, getting older.
Right.
I first worked in a nursing home when I was 16 years old as a nurse's aide, where I came into contact with quite a bit of dementia. So I've been observing dementia for a long time. We've had various family members and close friends. It's on my mind. And here's an interesting article by Gayatri Devi, who actually has written a book, Spectrum of Hope, An Optimistic and New Approach to Alzheimer's Disease and Other Dementias. And she points out that the disease exists on a spectrum. And we should be able to understand that patients can remain active and stay engaged. And in fact, those with functionality, maintaining a certain level of independence, are actually the majority of those suffering with Alzheimer's and other dementias.
Is that because they're early stages, or is she just saying it just never gets early, that bad?
Well, there's the possibility of finding it in early stages, maintaining it with certain drugs and treatments and regimens. And she cites in this article, which is taken from her book, she cites the example of Joe, who's 80, and he's a money manager, and noticed some diminution, and talks about how, you know, he got onto it right away, and he had some analysis done showing that he had both a good cognitive reserve and brain reserve, involving things like support, community, and exercise. Exercise, really key to keeping the brain
caused the disease to progress less quickly?
Well, it has relatively stabilized.
Really?
Because he had those factors in his favor, which are not inherent. I mean, you know, he's working on his... you know, brain exercises, et cetera, that they've devised, not just the things you hear on the radio. And he works at the exercise, et cetera. But he also takes a particular combination of approved medications in addition to, he's open to experimenting with, things under development. And he's actually stabilized, if not improved a little bit, to the extent where when he went to see his cardiologist and informed his cardiologist he had Alzheimer's, his cardiologist called Devi, his, Alzheimer's, his neurologist or whatever, in a rage and said, how dare you say this man has Alzheimer's? That's not at all the right diagnosis. He's fine.
Well, that's different. I mean, I did a case years ago where at that time the state of the art was that you could plot the progress of Alzheimer's really chronologically.
And it that's what she's reacting against.
1 year to stage two, 2 years to stage three, and there were certain behaviors associated with each stage. So, that's something.
Yeah.
I want to call it more good news. An article in the Times about fighting. It's called Kids, Would You Please Start Fighting? The article's thesis is that kids and really everybody benefits by arguing.
I think I brought this up before in a previous podcast.
You might have, but...
Yes, in a business situation, in a professional situation.
This time it's going to stick, I think, based on this.
But they've been saying this for years. This is news.
Well...
Remember they were saying a while ago that children with siblings do better in business situations.
Because they have to deal with each other.
Because they learn how to negotiate and
argue more,
and resolve problems.
But it's more than that. It's more than the behavioral aspect of it. It's actually reaching better results. That, as they put it, the skill to get hot without getting mad. That's what's called having a good argument, so that it doesn't become personal. That's the critical skill. And what it does is it battles what they call groupthink. They say groupthink is dangerous. You get everybody in a room and they all keep agreeing with each other aggressively, you're going to get a bad result. They're going to make a bad decision. And we've all been in committee meetings where not only does it feel that nothing's happening, but you feel that you're getting an unthinking result because the culture is so much against any kind of ostensible disagreement. As they put it here, if no one ever argues, you're not likely to give up on old ways of doing things, let alone try new ones. Disagreement is the antidote to groupthink. We're at our most imaginative when we're out of sync. I think that's entirely true. Some people do kind of recoil if you disagree with them. And I don't mean disagree by screaming at them, but disagree with them with real clarity.
Right.
Say, well, actually, I disagree with you entirely. You're 100% wrong.
Yes. Well, this is no surprise to me because you pretty much always disagree with me.
Well, it is kind of a loyalty thing.
And now I find out you're doing it for my benefit.
Well, I'm doing it for the benefit of the two of us because we'll get a better result. I think you'll catch up with me eventually. But look, it is a loyalty way of doing things. That is the adversary process that we have in our court system. But
it makes sense. It would certainly be a more creative process.
Yeah,
it's hard to imagine you get any new ideas
right
by lockstep groupthink.
That's right. And of course, as you say, that's consistent with the notion of aiding in child development.
Well, I love coffee.
Oh, okay.
So now I want to talk about coffee.
Yeah.
Just a little article adapted from Jeff Keeler's book about where the wild coffee grows. Not that interested in reading about coffee, but I just thought it was kind of interesting that, coffee comes from the Middle East. First seems to be around sometime during the 1500s. Yeah. Comes to Venice in around 1615, and people go crazy. They love it. And, of course, the Italians develop a whole coffee culture with the invention of the espresso machine by the 1800s. So I didn't realize it. It's not till the 19th century. I thought there was always espresso, but apparently not until the 19th century. Founder of... Starbucks, as we know it today, Howard Schultz, dreamed of being able to develop the atmosphere and ambiance of Italian coffee houses. Never quite happened.
Yeah, I was confused by this article. Their point is they said that's what he wanted to do, but he couldn't succeed. But I've been in Starbucks where people are just sitting around and hanging out. Isn't that consistent with the Italian model?
Apparently, I don't know. It's apparently not quite...
not as much as he had hoped?
Cohesive as...
I will tell you the difference in those Italian places. As you pointed out to me, they all drink out of ceramic cups.
Out of real cups. Largely standing up. You dart in.
Right.
Have your coffee at the bar and dart out. So you're right. It's a little bit confusing of an article.
Right.
But in any way, coffee goes back to 1615.
Yeah. And look, the Starbucks was a real departure, but it's pretty good coffee.
And almost immediately, people were attracted by the euphoria it creates.
Well, it gives you a buzz.
Okay. So if they only knew about the euphoria of pumpkin lattes.
Yeah. it's a good thing that we worked into that slowly. Just to go back to movies for a second, notwithstanding that I missed the Vincent Van Gogh movie, there are three movies that the Times previewed during the week as upcoming and keep your eye on. One being the latest Marvel movie called The Black Panther. I'm not a Marvel guy particularly in that connection. Two being Phantom Thread, what will be the last Daniel Day-Lewis movie in which he is a person who's who makes clothes, who sews clothes in a highly sophisticated bespoke fashion shop. And it's, you know, I'm sure it'll be interesting because everything Daniel Day-Lewis
does. That's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah. So
he's always interesting.
It can't fail to be interesting. But of course, the one which caught my eye, and I think everyone on New Jersey Transit, is that there is a movie coming up called The Commuter, starring Liam Neeson, in which as they
really they finally the commuter filmed your life.
It starts with someone buying
chose somebody
who looks just like me.
Yes.
It's like
it sounds just like
it's
you.
Almost as if they've been sniffing around and photographing and trying to get the guy who really is my doppelganger here. And it has as they described it a transportation theme. The star plays an insurance salesman who must determine which of his fellow railroad passengers is in mortal danger or risk the safety of his own loved ones. And I actually spend a lot of mornings trying to figure out which of my fellow passengers are in mortal danger or whether they're putting me in mortal danger. I can't quite figure that out. But, we can't miss this one. If I'm going to go with you to that other
movie. Wait a minute. Is this actually supposed to be any good or what?
I mean, it doesn't make any difference. It strikes so close to home.
Isn't there someone always on a train, like trying to save the whole train?
Look at this man's expression. He's,
I would say the train movie I want to see is Murder on the Orient Express.
Well, that's possible. That could be interesting.
So we go to a multiplex. You can go to the commuter. The commuter.
The commuter, right.
I'll go to the Leonardo.
I can see the Kenneth Branagh mustache is putting me off. I got to be honest with you. It's a little much.
Yeah, what do you think is up with that?
I don't know. It was a bad choice.
And it seems to have a life of its own.
Yeah. I mean, look, I enjoy the original, and, maybe this will live up to the original. I kind of doubt it, but even if it comes close, it's worth seeing. But jury's out.
It may be one of those situations where the sum of the parts is not equal to the parts.
Not equal to the whole.
The whole is not, you know
whole,
what I mean?
The whole is less than the sum of the parts,
these,
right.
Yeah. You have all these great actors and actresses, and it should be perfection, it should be amazing, it'd be nice if it's good.
I'm still down on the mustache. But we are closing with a nugget that only Tamsin and the paper
nugget.
Could find.
A nature nugget.
A nature nugget about the woolly mammoth.
Yeah. And it turns out the headline for this was something like, woolly mammoths die. It wasn't woolly. It was mammoths die in silly ways. And so I had to read about that because who's to say? Who's going around? Who made you judge of how mammoths die? But anyway, it turns out.
That seemed a little callous.
That they did an analysis. They can do DNA analysis of the remains of these mammoths that died anywhere from 60,000 years ago to 4,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And they have analyzed. There are many more male remains than female.
Yeah.
More than you would think
would
make sense
right.
in any random sample.
Right.
Okay. It's not totally random because these are the remains of animals that died in such a way that their remains would be preserved.
Right.
Safe from predators or whatever and buried and preserved for us to find it 60,000 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And their theory is that the woolly mammoth society was like the elephant society, kind of matriarchal, and that the females are in charge and they know everything. And yet at a certain point, the young males have to, go out on their own or want to, are driven to go out on their own and do their own thing. And they do stupid things and end up in mud holes and sinkholes and tar pits or whatever.
Right.
And
they're the ones whose remains are preserved.
If they had just stayed home and did what their mothers told them to do.
You're sugarcoating it. What they found was the men were stupid. The men and the women were much smarter, and they lived to a ripe old age and died in bed.
So it's excellent that we have this advanced technology to let us know these things.
Woolly mammoth culture apes, human culture, apparently, if I could use that metaphor. Perhaps. I'm sure that's the way you see it. So in any event, thanks for listening to Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper, and we'll see you next week.
We'll see you at the movies.
At the movies.